everybody. Nirad Chopra with Sidebar Advisors. Hope you are doing well. Today's guest is Steve Fretson. Steve is the founder of Fretson Inc. He calls himself a business development therapist. He coaches and trains attorneys on modern day business development skills, providing precise tips, fresh ideas, and actionable tasks that can drive tangible results. He has over 20 years of coaching experience and has been featured in the Chicago Tribune, Cranes, Entrepreneur.com, has appeared on NBC News, WGN Radio. He's authored 3 books on legal business development, and is a regular contributor to the Chicago Daily Law Bulletin. He's published articles in Attorney at Law Magazine, the National Law Review, the American Bar Association, and the Illinois State Bar Association. So he's definitely well-renowned. Additionally, he's also the host of the Be That Lawyer podcast, where he and his guests teach new methodologies for growing and sustaining a legal practice. Steve, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me. Happy to be here.
Thank you. So I'm going to be remiss if I don't ask this question, and I don't want to spend a whole lot of time on it, but when you look at your LinkedIn profile, one of your titles is Plane Crash Survivor. Can you tell us a little bit about that? Because I don't think we've talked to anybody who's been in that scenario before, and it sounds terrifying.
That's because they're all dead.
Yeah, probably. Well,
not everybody dies, but mainly people that are in plane crashes really die. But yeah, the long and the short is I was in my 20s flying up with some friends on a small plane. And on the way back from our little jaunt up north in Wisconsin, I'm in Chicago, we ran out of gas. And the pilot to this day, not allow that to be known or to be agreed to, but it is what it is. They found very little gas in the plane. And by the way, we didn't explode. So that's also how there wasn't gas in the plane. But anyway, we lost our engine and there's a lot that goes into it to that story. It's about a 45-minute story to go through the whole thing. But the short version is, I probably shouldn't be here. I should probably be dead, but I did survive. I was a human pretzel for a number of months and was able to recover because one of the reasons I was in my 20s at the time. So good time to be in an accident of that nature and recovered. And the main takeaway, other than always have gas in a plane, is you got one shot at this thing called life, Nirad. So you can screw around and have fun and not take things seriously. And I enjoy having a good time too. But we also have to appreciate every day is valuable and every day that you waste doing things that maybe aren't productive, aren't helpful, aren't leaving this planet better than you found it. I see things very differently going through a near-death experience than most people.
Would you have considered it a gift like they typically say in these scenarios?
Oh, it's absolutely a gift. Like I said, I mean, the fact that I have a life, a company, a wife, a beautiful kid and all that, that would not happen in the tragedy of my family losing me and in that type of way. At a young age, 26 years old, to lose a son, a brother, a sister. Mm-hmm. So yeah, absolutely a gift. Every day is a gift.
And do you fly on planes now or has that?
I'm a professional pilot now. No, I'm not. But I have flown in small planes. I have flown in large planes. I like to think of myself as a certified rabbit's foot because the likelihood of getting in one plane crash, let alone two, is very small.
So, okay, good.
Yeah, I mean, so that, by the way, just I'll mention, if anyone wants to check out the entire story of that, if you go to my LinkedIn profile, type in Steve Fretson, go to my LinkedIn. One of the featured podcasts that I did was called Uncorking a Story. And I go through the whole gory, terrible, terrifying thing. So that's a way to take in the entire story, if that's of your interest.
Yeah, I mean, that's, we'll definitely put a link up there. I mean, it sounds terrifying. I remember a couple of times that I've been in severe turbulence and I'm afraid of flying since. I mean, I'm not saying I don't get on a plane, but it was enough for me. So I can imagine crash landing type of scenario. And who was the pilot? It wasn't one of your friends that was in the plane with you, correct?
Yeah, it was one of my best friends at the time. And he was the pilot and was a flight instructor. And he, look, I'm not going to get into the details or anything, but long and the short is that it went through a long court and trial and everything, and it was found to be pilot error.
And I take it you're not friends at this point.
I mean, I see him on LinkedIn. He's still out there. He's still networking. He seems like he's got a great family and a great life and all that. And I'm happy for him. I don't harbor any ill will beyond shame on him if it was the case. But anyway, I'm not someone to hold grudges because quite frankly, life's too short.
Well, glad that you're here with us now, and I'm sure that changed your perspective in ways that we could never imagine. But let's talk about your professional career. So you went to the University of Illinois where you got your Bachelor of Science. How did you end up in the coaching realm and let alone specifically working with attorneys?
Yeah, sure. So to clarify, I went to Illinois State. I was a terrible student. So the fact that I even got into Illinois State was pretty much a good fortune. school and just being a ADHD in the 70s and 80s, you were just called stupid and lazy and unfocused. And so I kind of came up that way and was just barely able to eke out some grades to get into college. And when I went through school, I just needed to get the BS, which I think is funny. It's called a BS, Bachelor of Science, but it's also BS. But it helped me get into sales, which is where I ended up spending most of my time. And I had been selling since I was 16 years old.
What were you selling at 16?
I was selling shoes. There was an oldie times shoe store called Kinney's. It was a franchise or company owned, but the Great American Shoe Store partnered with Foot Locker. And so I worked at Kinney's, I worked at Foot Locker, I worked at Athlete's Foot, I worked at American Eagle for a while in the summer. And I always found that I had a knack for talking to people. I had a knack for helping people find the right shoe or find the right this or whatever. But that was the very basics. But when I graduated from college and I said, hey, I want to make a good living and I seem to enjoy this type of thing. And I went into sales and I moved up the food chain of sales. I ended up in franchising, selling businesses around the country, which is a more complex sale. But the other piece of it though, Niraj, is I had to also oversee 50 independently run franchises. So I was more of like a business coach and a salesperson for this company. And so I enjoyed selling, but I also enjoyed helping others. I enjoyed taking an owner by the hand and saying, hey, we need to go out and sell today and go and do that. And I was able to do some coaching. And it really got me hungry to not only own my own business, but also to sort of figure out like, what business did I want to own? What did I want to do?
Did you consider a franchise for yourself being in that world?
I did. I looked at all available options. I think at one point I was thinking, hey, there aren't a lot of Dairy Queens in Chicago. Maybe I should open up a Dairy Queen because who doesn't like that? And then it was just a ridiculous, you know, thing. But what ended up happening is instead of starting my own business, I got a job at a different franchisor who said, hey, if you're going to come work for me, kid at the time, I'm 2 years old or whatever. He says, you need to meet my coach. I go, what do you mean coach? He goes, I have a sales coach. I go, what is that? I've never heard of that. I don't know about that. I've been to a Brian Tracy, Tony Robbins seminar, but that's about it. And he says, look, this guy took me from doing like 10, 15 deals a year to doing over 30, 35. And I owe it all to this guy. I was like, okay, well, you've got my attention. I'll meet with the guy. And sure enough, I met with him. He was able to identify my gaps and identify how much more I could be doing if I had better systems and methods and everything. Engaged him for a lot of money. And after 6 months, I had made more money than I had in my entire career in a year, in 6 months, because this guy was so spot on in identifying where I was wasting time, where I needed to. I just never had like a structure to follow. And I said to him after 6 months, I go, how do I do what you do? And he said, well, you pay me even more money than you have, and I'll show you. So I did that. And I ended up starting my own sales coaching business back in 2004. It was called Sales Results, Inc. Sales Results. So great for entrepreneurs, terrible for lawyers. Lawyers did not like the name, but I still was able to pick up a ton of business in 2008-09 with the recession, working with lawyers and law firms. And it ended up being such a big part of my business that I said, you know what? This is an industry that needs me. I have a very sales-free approach that I had created based on what I had learned from this coach and from tons and tons of study and basically borrowing and stealing ideas and then morphing them into my own philosophy I call sales-free selling, and started working with lawyers, and it's sort of been exclusive ever since.
So this coach, you said that he taught you how to be better with your time. So it sounds like he was stripping away things that were not as productive to allow for things that were some of those examples of stuff that like, wow, this really isn't fruitful for my career.
I mean, I'll give you the number one thing. Mm-hmm. I was like the master of the crowded pipeline. Okay. Meaning that I always had lots and lots of people that were interested in buying a franchise from me, but I would spend 6 months, a year, even longer working with them, talking with them, trying to convince them, trying to get them to sign, trying to get my deals in for the year and all that. And what this guy sort of identified was, I had a very busy pipeline, but it was mostly filled with crap. It was mostly filled with think about its maybes and I'll get back to you. It was a lot of chasing after people and trying to figure out ways to get them to sign instead of driving up urgency, identifying qualifications and focusing on the people that are most likely to buy that actually it's a good fit and forward with them and get rid of all the people that were just clouding up my time. And it was a huge aha moment for me because I was always encouraged to try to close everybody and try to right. fill the pipeline with anybody and any a heartbeat and a checkbook. And it never felt right. It never felt right. So when I started working with this coach and he identified that was one of a number of things, but that was probably the biggest aha was you can actually move someone to a no and that's okay. And that's become more commonplace now in most sales training and most philosophies, but back in the early 2000s, less so.
It wasn't common knowledge though. So at the time you started coaching businesses, were you an entrepreneur yourself at that stage or were you working for a different company for this coaching business?
No, this was something I started on my own.
Okay.
And I had this coach, I worked, this coach kind of coached me on how to run the business. So I did have some help in getting it started.
Okay. And you're starting to get some businesses. How were you finding people to sign up with you? And do you remember your first client?
Yeah, absolutely. It was 100% networking. And I remember the first networking event I went to, I met a number of people. One was a real estate agent, broker, and I met with him for coffee at Starbucks. And we talked it through. I made him a deal he couldn't refuse. Basically, like only when you win, do I win. It was like, I just needed, the goal was when starting my own business was, it really wasn't about money. It was, I need to get some clients. Mm-hmm. I need to get some traction. Sorry. So it wasn't so much about, hey, can you pay me all this money? It was really, hey, can you pay me just like a little bit of money and then let me work with you and let's get some business in the door and then you can pay me off of that. And that was like the first client. And I came home with the check for $1,000 after my first meeting with this guy. And I showed my wife, I go, look, I've been in business for 10 hours or whatever. And here I've already got a client. And then the second client, second guy I met with, signed. The third client I went with signed. So I was definitely on some kind of a high mm-hmm. because what the way that I was approaching them was the way that I was going to teach them how to sell. So here's people in need that aren't selling enough. I'm using a system to help get them to work with me and make sure it's a fit, qualify, and all that. And in doing so, they got to sort of see a demonstration of how I was going to work with them.
Was business coaching a crowded space at the time?
No, it really wasn't too bad. I mean, there was a Sandler. Sandler was kind of the big player and still is in the franchise space for sales training. So I was competing against local Sandler and some other consultants. But I mean, not like today. It's maybe 5 or 10 times the number of consultants and coaches that are out and about opening up a shingle. Just if things get hard as a lawyer, well, I'll just be a coach. Things like that. So, and I'm not saying there's anything wrong with that. There are people that were meant to coach and that should, and there's people that definitely should not be in the space, but are.
I mean, I work with a financial coach and he'll be the first to tell you that he didn't make it as a financial advisor, but he is a fantastic coach. So,
well, right. But I like that. I like that admission of this didn't work for me, but it's a lot of people say, hey, I made $1 million as a lawyer and now I'm going to become a lawyer coach mm-hmm. because I know everything. And the reality is that the way that they did it and what worked for them and what made them get to a million or successful, that may work for 10% of the people that are out there.
So you start hustling. Wife's obviously happy because unlike most businesses, you're starting off with, sounds like, with a profit. How did you transition to lawyers? Like, was there one lawyer that spread the word? Was it getting in front of a group? How did that happen?
Yeah. So when the recession of 2008-09 hit and lawyers' hours were down, general counsels were losing their jobs, lawyers were losing their jobs from private practice because guess what? They didn't have a book of business and they didn't really realize that their job was at stake or their livelihood was at stake because they didn't have their own clients. Now that's become a fact. I mean, that's if you're a lawyer and you don't realize that not having your own clients is detrimental to your career, well, then you're sleeping behind the wheel. That being said, only 10% of lawyers take action to really turn a corner, either hiring a coach or really studying business development as a skill to try to get ahead on their client development. It's still a very small percentage that, but my feeling was that when I worked with enough businesses and started working with lawyers and they were being referred to me by my entrepreneur clients, not only again, did I see a need for them. They don't learn any of this in law school. They don't learn at the law firm level. They're all just kind of winging it. And I'll give you the best sort of example of why lawyers for me are better for me than salespeople and entrepreneurs. And you can tell me how you feel about this. When I work with, let's say, a financial professional like yourself, okay, and you've been through three, four, five different trainings over your 10-year, 20-year career, okay? It's like a whiteboard that has scribbles all over it, scribbles and crosses out. And it's like all these different platforms that they had studied and learned and tried and used or not used or whatever. And to say, hey, I'm going to erase all that and start new with a fresh model or fresh methodology to use was very difficult. They had a lot of bad habits. Lawyers, for the most part, they have no plan. They have no methodology. They've learned nothing. So they're just out hustling, trying to get business. But when they can stop and take a breath and put a plan in place and put a methodology in place that says, step one, do this, say that, ask this. Step two, and then they go through all these steps and they start to execute on a methodology that's proven and works, then they buy in and then they have a way to do things in a much more efficient way. And it just spread like wildfire. And now looking back 16 years, all I've done is help attorneys double, triple, quadruple their books of business and keep every year as their best year, make every year their best year. So it's been an absolute blessing and it's been a lot of fun. I feel like I work with the nicest, best, smartest people in the world. And the guys that are crazy, that have egos and all that, they don't hire me anyway because they know everything already. Yeah. Just ask them.
Hey everyone, Neeraj Chhabra here. Hope you're enjoying today's episode of the Sidebar Advisor podcast. If you're unfamiliar with Sidebar Advisors, we are a financial planning firm that works primarily with attorneys. Whether you're a solo practitioner or equity partner, attorneys have a unique set of financial circumstances. They generally start their careers with significantly more student loan debt than other professionals, are phased out of certain retirement vehicles, and their kids typically do not qualify for financial aid. Many attorneys may be capped on how much of their salary can go into retirement vehicles, leaving them vulnerable to taxes. If this sounds like you, you may want to consider giving us a call. At Sidebar Advisors, we go beyond financial planning. We also offer CLE programs at law firms, including our flagship course, Financial Empowerment for Women in Law. Depending on your jurisdiction, it may meet the requirements for D&I. Additionally, we host monthly virtual networking events exclusively for lawyers, connecting you with other like-minded legal professionals. If you're interested in learning more or would like to schedule a complimentary consultation, check us out at www.sidebaradvisors.com. Investment advisory services are offered through Mariner Platform Solutions, an SEC-registered investment advisor. Mariner Platform Solutions and Sidebar Advisors are not affiliated entities. Thanks for listening. Now back to the episode. So you talk about financial advisors as an example. How do you stand out as a lawyer? Because I know if I go to a networking event and people hear, oh, you're a financial advisor, number one, they're going to make assumptions that they know what we do. And number two, they're staying clear. They don't want to network with financial advisors because it's well known that we're going to be at every event and really just not people you want to be typically associating with at a networking event. Attorneys are a very different animal because you're so specific to your practice area. So how do you stand out? How do you get your message across? And how do you get in front of the people that could actually hire you?
Well, so what I'm working with attorneys on every day is developing a plan. And this is like a high-end GPS that's going to get them from where they are to where they want to be with the least amount of friction. So identifying their targets. Who are their targets that are the best clients for them? Who are their targets for the best strategic partners or referral partners? So like, I don't think I would be networking with you as a straight-up financial planner. The fact that you focus on attorneys and I focus on attorneys makes us a much more compatible partnership, right? For us to network together. So I'm teaching them how to go after the people who are going to make the most sense and ask, learn about them, add value for them, and ask questions that are going to identify that they're ultimately qualified to continue to spend time with. So it's a little bit like I said earlier, where we have this pipeline filled with people. And our job is to identify who we want to move forward and who we want to move out so we can keep it as clean as possible that we're only dealing with the best people. And that doesn't mean you don't meet with a lot of people. You still can. But there's people I meet with where I know it's going to be a one and done. And there's people I meet with where I go, you know what, Neeraj, you need to get on my podcast. I need to get on your podcast. I'm going to help you get people to your event. You're going to help people get my event. Like, we're going to do stuff together because there's so much synergy. And we're both qualified and we're both like good guys and all that stuff. So it's helping them figure that out, navigate what are the best events to go to, where those people are. And most importantly, again, be prepared to ask questions, what the right questions, and also have an infomercial that's going to separate you from the pack. So I'll give an example. One of my clients is a former Marine, a former firefighter, and a former cop. He's now a lawyer doing family law. How many family law attorneys are there in Chicago? Well, let's just say thousands and thousands, okay? So how does he separate himself? Well, he wasn't. So we talked it over and I go, I don't know that you need to work with everybody. You can, but ultimately, wouldn't it make sense for you to focus on military and firefighters and cops and people that are first responders, couldn't we separate you from all the other family attorneys if you had a hook where they said, that's the guy I want to work with because he's like me? So we came up with like first response family law. And now he's still able to work with anybody, but he's definitely in a position to target and go after the first responders to be their go-to. So it's things like that, that I, and I'm not a marketing genius or anything, but it's like, to me, some of the stuff is sort of like obvious. And to lawyers who are like in it, it may not be.
Yeah, exactly. They're not teaching this in law school. So let's take that example a little bit further. Okay, so this person decides to focus on first responders and military families in the area of family law. What's next for that individual? Where should they be going hypothetically to meet people that are going to need a family law attorney that happen to be in those sectors?
Yeah, so you could be offering to speak at the union meetings about how to protect yourself from a divorce. That could be a presentation that's done. It's in the form of articles that are being written. It's in the form of attending events that are cop, firefighter, military run events where those people get together. And it's mostly about branding, like putting it out there and just building the brand around that differentiator. So people just know, like people know that I'm the lawyer coach. They know that I'm the person you go to. And they don't think I'm everything to everybody. They know me for a very specific thing. All of my content, all of my networking, everything leads down to one path. It's everyone knows what I do. So that's putting that in a plan and then putting that into action. And again, staying with a client over a period of time to make sure that they're getting the traction. We're making adjustments and changes, improving things, and then continuing to make sure that everything is leading down the right path.
So that makes sense if you're trying to work with individuals in the field of, let's say, family law or trust and estates. Those are focused on specific people. But what if you do some sort of corporate work? How do you get in front of those decision makers? Because that's a whole different animal altogether. In theory, anybody could be your client if you're dealing with individuals, but much, much harder to break into a company.
Yes and no. I don't know that it's that different. And I'll tell you why. I mean, there's lawyers that I evaluate and a lot of the low-hanging fruit of where they could be going and what they could be doing to get in front of those GCs and CEO clients, they're not going after it because there's a discomfort there or a lack of knowledge on how to do it. It's very uncomfortable. So to give an example, I'm at a mid-market firm and I'm doing M&A. Okay, that's my focus. So I'm only thinking about how do I bring in M&A work, but I'm not thinking about the commercial real estate. I'm not thinking about the litigation. I'm not thinking about the high-end estate planning, the tax, all the stuff that is necessary for my clients that I don't do, but I could bring in and hand off to my partners, right? So I'm bringing in all this business. Let's say it's $1 million. I'm not actually doing that work. I've got great partners who can do it. And that's one of a number of ways to do it. Okay. The other thing I could do is go to my partners who do these other things and say, hey, I'd like to talk about your clients and obviously have a relationship and know that you want to interact with them. But, you know, they've got a dozen, two dozen, three dozen clients that the firm isn't doing M&A with. They're doing commercial real estate. They're doing other things when they could also be doing M&A. So I can work with that lawyer to say, hey, why don't we partner? Let's get me in to meet some of your clients. Let me find out what their M&A needs are, what their expansion needs are, how they're going to do the future. Maybe there's an opportunity to bring that business in as well. So everybody's winning in that scenario. So that's one example. I'll give you the better one. A lawyer has, let's say, two dozen clients, corporate clients. Those corporate clients think that this lawyer's phenomenal. I mean, the lawyer does a great job, great service, great quality, fair price, and super responsive. So let's say you put in the work to build a relationship, everything is above board, but the lawyers aren't asking for introductions. They feel like it's either beneath them or they feel like it's uncomfortable. And for many of them, it is. I mean, because they don't have an approach, a system or language to use in order to make that into the client's idea or to make that into a mutually beneficial conversation. Or just to ensure that because the GC that you're working with is the one that knows all the other GCs, right? That's like, you don't need to go to a conference for 3 days and wander around like in the blind, although you could certainly do that. It's one option. This is lower hanging fruit. So by my teaching them how to go and approach their clients again in a non-salesy way to generate introductions that could be direct business, that's also going to be far better than say attending a networking event or cold calling or something they're never going
to
do.
So to a certain degree, it is networking, just more internal networking within.
Correct. I meant not meeting. They're not out meeting with strangers.
They're not going to the
chamber. In a networking event. It's really, yeah, internal networking with your clients, with your partners, with your current like law school friends that you haven't talked to. Maybe if you're at a mid-market firm, talk to some big firm attorneys. They probably have rate pressures and conflict clients that they can't take on that they could be passing down to you. There's all these things that are kind of happening and lawyers just aren't seeing them. Maybe in a similar way, the way I wasn't seeing them until I met with a coach, right? And was able to open my eyes to there was so much more for me that I just didn't know because I was inside of my own little world.
Let's talk about that world. So a lot of these lawyers, maybe they want to do these things and maybe they completely buy into the strategy, but how do you find the time between billable hours and your senior partners kind of telling you what you should or should not be doing in any given day? How do you transition from, okay, I'm the low-level associate to I am the rainmaker. I am going balancing that time, getting away from my desk to bring in my own business.
Yeah. It's like saying, how do you eat an elephant one bite at a time, right? Mm-hmm. So it's, you have to make it a priority. You have to study time management. I'm working with my clients on time management and how to delegate and how to just get out of their inbox, how to do these things so that they have and can create time to do business development. Here's the dirty little secret too. If there's a lawyer who's already putting out a significant amount of effort and time on business development, and it's being ineffective in how it's getting results, if they were working through a plan and a process and a system that was proven effective, how much they may have to spend some time to learn that. But once they learn that, aren't they going to then save hundreds and even into thousands of hours on the rest of their career? The answer is absolutely. Mm-hmm. So it's like anything, you have to invest in working out to play better at a sport, right? If you want to play at the higher level, then you have to get into shape. It's the same thing with business development. You have to put in a little bit of time to be able to play at a high level.
So a couple of times you've talked about things like non-salesy and sales-free selling and things of that nature. You know, even in your prior example, you were talking about networking internally with your colleagues and coaching them on how to spot these opportunities for you, or networking with your existing GC clients and find out who they know. Everything you're talking about basically sounds like the opposite of networking. Are you saying that you don't feel that networking is effective or an efficient use of your time, or what are your thoughts on it?
Networking is absolutely a great way to go. However, if done without a system and without intelligence, it can be a tremendous time suck. So if you read my second book, is called The Attorney's Networking Handbook. I'm pretty sure I start off that book saying, no one has networked and wasted more time that I know than I have. So I've put in the time to make all the mistakes, to learn from those mistakes, and then to hopefully help people from making the same mistakes. So if you're going to do networking, that could be internally with your firm. If that's going to be externally joining groups like Provisors and USA 500 or Chambers of Commerce or whatever it might be, if you do it with a method and a process and a system with language and questions, you're just going to be so much more effective at helping others and getting business and building your brand than if you're just winging it. So it's all about trying to help people just, again, be their best versions, but there's a price to be paid, and that's in the form of education. People need to get educated on networking. And I'll give you one networking question that is an absolute game changer for most people. I believe that you're good for me. You believe that I'm good for you. And I ask you, in an average year, how many lawyers, and you don't have to answer this for real, but like in an average year, how many lawyers that you talk to are interested in really growing their law practices, like really going to the next level, making equity, and just really blowing it out? I'm just curious. And you tell me probably 15 a year. Okay. That's music to my ears, because that means you're interacting with people who may be a good fit for me. Hungry, ambitious, interested in growth. Yes. If you said to me, Steve, in the 10 years I've been doing this, it's never come up. Well, that's a very different answer. So part of it is building relationships, and part of it is also qualifying people on their ability to network at a high level with you. And that's, again, not something that's being done enough.
Okay. So asking the right questions, you're talking about basically being in the right place. So networking in groups where there's people with the capacity to refer you business. Is that fair?
Yeah. Yeah. So like an estate planner and a financial planner are talking, and you identify that the estate planner is absolutely clueless and isn't helpful and is never going to refer anybody and doesn't take the time and never will. Well, that's not an estate planner that you want to bring into your team. That's not someone that you want to spend a lot more time with. You're not going to turn that person around. Mm-hmm. But an estate planner that says, I've got 500 clients, half of them need half of them need financial advisors. And the one I have now is a total lunatic. And I need someone like you, Niraj. Well, I don't think you're going to let go too quickly of that person. That's one that you might want to just say, let's keep talking. This is interesting.
It sounds like a unicorn scenario. Oh, well, you have tons of clients and the guy that I'm using right now is just not doing a good job. But what if they say something like, I have tons of clients and I have a strong relationship with XYZ professional.
Mm-hmm.
Is that another person that you kind of dismiss the same way that you would have the first scenario? Or do you?
I would want to ask a few more questions. One might be, how are they? That sounds great. And just out of curiosity, how are they reciprocating? Are you getting the equal amount that you're getting, that you're giving as it relates to how you're floating them business and how they're floating you business? And let's say that in most cases, the answer is no. That might be an opening. Okay. Let's say the answer is yes. Well, wouldn't it be nice to have two of those? I mean, what if you had two people that were sending you work and you're maybe giving out two names instead of one? And let us work it out. Sometimes there's a crack in the door, and it's just a matter of putting your hand on the door and pushing it open a little further to see what else might be there. And I'll also say, it's not an easy job networking in the sense that, let's say that it is estate planners that you're talking to, Niraj, and you might have to meet with five to get one that actually knows how to play ball, that actually gets what you're able to do and what they're able to do for you. So you have to go in and, I guess, kiss some ugly babies or whatever we want to call it. But here's the thing. You don't want to have to follow up and maintain a relationship with five people. It would be easier for you to maintain and build a relationship with one person and discount the other four because you qualified or disqualified them out or in. And that's part of what I'm trying to teach people so they can spend more time with the right people and less time with the wrong people.
One other question that I was curious about, you're talking about all these different networking strategies and the fact that they don't teach this in law school, which I agree with you, that's some valuable skill, how to actually grow a practice. But how does your branding, your networking, your marketing, I guess is a more appropriate term, change depending on whether you're a solo practitioner or you're an associate at an Am Law 100 versus you are an associate or partner at another firm, et cetera?
I think it's changing based on who, again, your targets are. A solo practitioner is going to generally work with smaller companies, and it might be like in their area, where an Am Law 100 partner is, again, going to be working with larger organizations, general counsel, CEOs, folks of like that. So I think that what I'm, and I'm working with both, but I'm working with very large firm attorneys and I'm working with solos. I'm teaching them the same stuff. We just have to tweak it for, again, who their targets are. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Yeah.
You talk about branding can be fun. I don't know too many attorneys that look forward to business development. How do you actually make it fun, something that they're looking forward to and not something that they dread every day?
Yeah. I try to take away the salesiness out of it. It's a lot more of questioning, listening, empathy, understanding, it's almost like you're a detective trying to find clues and eventually to find out who the murderer was in this scene. In this case, the clues are qualifying someone that they're a good fit for you and you're a good fit for them. And then ultimately, how do you walk a buyer through a buying decision to see if it's a fit? And that takes a lot of the pressure off, as opposed to, I have to close this deal. I have to make the pitch. I have to perform. And so taking away some of that, I mean, I've got clients that are locking up business, significant business, with saying almost nothing. Like, they might talk 10% of the time in the meeting. So we're doing a lot more listening, a lot more asking, trying to get people to share with us their problems, their pain, their needs. And we're driving up urgency so that the lawyer has to sell less, has to quote less rates, they're getting pushed by the buyer. How do we get this started? How do we move this forward? But in branding, marketing, business development, a little bit different. They're all going towards the same direction, but they're all pieces of the puzzle, but they're different in the sense that business development is more one-on-one, marketing and branding is more one-to-many, messaging, things like that. Yeah.
And one final question is, let's assume somebody is listening and they're like, you know what? I Steve's right. I need to start to develop business if I want to have any type of either a long-term career in the legal industry or grow my practice and really move up the ranks. What should their next steps be?
So you've got three options. You've got more than three options, but here are three. One is just keep doing what you're doing. And if it's working, great. If it's not, that's not good. Number two is become a student of business development. I have 3-4 books out there, podcasts, videos, all kinds of content that you can take in to start getting your skills up. And the third is to really consider, highly consider engaging a coach. And I'm one of, again, a dozen that I know in the space. I think I might be the only one that has a combination of coaching and actual skills training classes. And the lawyers that I work with care about education. They care about learning these skills and internalizing them so they have them for the rest of their career. So people can reach out to me directly if they want to have a 30-minute sort of evaluation meeting. And that meeting is me asking a lot of questions, walking them through to understand what the potential is, where the gaps are, do we want to move forward together? And then I invite them to class. I invite them to talk to clients. Like, I'm very transparent because I'm only working with a certain number of lawyers a year, and I want them to go in with their eyes open the same way that I want to make sure it's a good fit.
And if they want to find this information, where would they go?
So my website is fretzin.com, F-R-E-T-Z-I-N. You can email me at steve@fretzin.com. You can check out Amazon for my books. Just type my name in, and the podcast, Be That Lawyer. Great way to get a sense for how I, you know, like, you've done a great job asking me questions and kind of pulling out some good things. And I like to chime in on my interviews with my 2 cents. So I think it's like that way people can really get a flavor for how I coach as well as how I interview.
Well, Steve, thank you very much for sharing some insights with our audience, and appreciate you coming on.
Yeah, thank you.